Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
Well, good morning, everybody. Good morning. I'm going to have to interrupt your conversations so that we can commence contemporary issues. Otherwise, it'll become past issues before we have a chance to talk about it. Story of your life. So, we have just a couple more sessions left to talk about the letter from Birmingham Jail. We're going to wrap up before Easter. After Easter, we get about 3 weeks, quick before the sort of the end of the program year and sort of life charges on into summer. After Easter, I'm working on right now putting some information together about climate change and sort of what climate change means from our perspective as a church. And working on getting some of that information together, sort of what do we know, what does it matter, what can we do about it? We're going to try to sort of squeeze that into a very short period of time after Easter. We do not meet on Easter Sunday. We will hold worship on Easter Sunday, so do plan to be here for that.
Okay.
but we won't be meeting as contemporary issues on Easter Sunday. We're going to turn today to Dr. King answering the charge of being an extremist. That was, again, one of the charges sort of brought against him in the letter signed by the 8 clergymen who felt that he just needed to tone things down. And by the way, he was an outsider coming into Birmingham. That wasn't the first time or the last time that he was labeled as an extremist. This is sort of in conversation with this question about, why are you having these demonstrations and these marches? Why not sit down at the table with these well-meaning segregationists and have a negotiated conversation with them? I read that paragraph to you last week. Why are you having direct actions, sit-ins, marches, and so forth? And he says, yes, of course we need to negotiate, but those we need to negotiate with won't come to the table unless we create such a crisis that what's been going on under the surface is revealed for what it is. I'm going to read one other paragraph that he, well, I'll read two paragraphs here that I think are going to sort of bring us to the to that conversation. Then I'll turn to a couple more later on that really is specifically do some great work around the idea of extremism. This is, if you've got your letter with you, it's at the bottom of page 3, the final two paragraphs. Again, Dr. King is responding to these clergymen who have written a letter calling for, some calm and some slow down and let things kind of play out. And he says, I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the last few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizens' counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice. who constantly says, "I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I can't agree with your methods of direct action," who paternalistically feels that he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by the myth of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait until a, quote, more convenient season. Shallow understanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. In your statement, you asserted that our actions, even though peaceful, must be condemned because they precipitate violence. But can this assertion be logically made? Isn't this like condemning the robbed man because his possession of money precipitated the evil acts of robbery? Isn't this like condemning Socrates because his unswerving commitment to truth and his philosophical delvings precipitated the misguided popular mind to make him drink the hemlock? Isn't this like condemning Jesus because his unique God consciousness and never-ceasing devotion to his will precipitated the evil act of crucifixion? We must come to see, as federal courts have consistently affirmed, that it is immoral to urge an individual to withdraw his efforts to gain his basic constitutional rights because the quest precipitates violence. Society must protect the robbed and punish the robber. And Christian Churches Today responds, "Dr. King's letter calls the church to work for change by bringing social tensions to the surface and then channeling the resulting discontent into the creative outlet of nonviolent direct action. We must promote research and reporting on racial issues, expose hidden injustices, and provide opportunities for those without a voice to share their stories. In our media-saturated, controversy-hungry society, we must work to differentiate between empty sensationalism and constructive tension. We must not expose painful truths merely in order to attract media attention, but to generate opportunities for meaningful healing action. We also must not be afraid to risk new tensions in race relations by challenging the reigning belief that we live in a post-racial society. Candid conversations about race often expose suppressed racial hostility, but they should not be condemned as the cause. We must encourage dialogue that dispels misunderstanding and prejudice, while confronting rhetoric that perpetuates, quote, the bondage of myths and half-truths." So those who authored the study guide are recognizing that it remains necessary for us to bring tension to the surface and to allow tension to come to the surface, even though that is uncomfortable for us as those who are otherwise comfortable with the way things are. So think back, if you will, to the march in Birmingham, the series of marches in Birmingham, either as you remember them at the time, or the ways that you have since looked back at them as history. They're now 56 years in the past. So either as you experienced them at the time or as you look back on them as history, what did the March on Birmingham say to the rest of the country about the circumstances and situation of the Jim Crow South?
Give me that question again, please.
In what way did the marches in Birmingham reveal to the country the nature of the Jim Crow South? The things that were going on under the surface there. In what way did the march bring those to the surface? Pamela.
I remember back about that time, I was a teenager.
Uh-huh.
And we lived in Rochester, New York area. And a bunch of church youth, we went downtown, and I remember, you know, doing peace things and saying, I mean, in response to that, but, you know, it just also, you know, makes me think when you talk about that, you know, I like peace and order and comfort. And especially because, you know, that's comfortable. But it also leads to inertia.
Right.
And even though you don't want to do something, you don't really know what to do because you don't want to cause a riot. I mean, don't you want to do stuff in a peaceful way that it doesn't happen that way?
All right. Yeah. So on the one hand, you experienced and participated in some of the reaction to the actions in Birmingham in your northern city.
Yeah.
And there's a whole layer of this letter that I think has to call us to account for our perspective on the North. And did anybody live in the South during, I'll start with during the 60s. Bob, I know you have lived in Texas, which is, it's a different flavor of South than the South that sort of is Louisiana and East.
I used to travel down in Alabama. Small towns down there.
Yeah.
It's a different world than here.
Right. So so it's important for us, I think, to, on the one hand, know the ways in which it is a different world, and to recognize the ways in which it's not so different after all. That's a piece of what, it's not directly addressed in the letter, although the way that the letter is addressed to white moderates is working on speaking to that. Dr. King spent a lot of time in the North and spent a lot of time really irritating people in the North because he would travel to, he would travel to Boston and he would travel to Detroit and he would travel to Los Angeles, which thought it was in the North, even though it's almost at the southern end of California. But he would travel to these places and say, it's just as bad here as it is in the South. You just can't see it as clearly. And the ways that the legal structures mask the social structures. He had very little patience for Northern moderates as well, and was, again, certainly by the time of his death, but throughout his life, he was popular with Northern moderates until he started talking. And then once he started talking, he was calling us to account as well. For the ways that the South is another place, but it's not so other. And so I think that's a piece of the way that the letter has to speak to us too. On the one hand, if we were there at the time, what would we have done? And on the other hand, given where we were, what did we do? Given where we are, what are we doing? Which is part of what this this demonstration process was about surfacing what is otherwise sort of invisible under the surface.
Wasn't Lyndon Johnson also prompting him to bring these things to the surface through demonstrations?
So Johnson was not president yet at the time.
Okay. Later.
Later, when the so throughout the process in Birmingham, and then it was about a year after, I believe, that the Civil Rights Act was passed. It was much later when the Civil Rights Act was finally fully implemented. I'll let you know when it happens. Dr. King and the other organizers in the SCLC and SNCC and so forth were very much in conversation with it was the Kennedy administration at the time, and they were also kind of a black eye for the Kennedy administration. So this is a piece of what's going to of what Dr. King identifies as his disappointment with the white moderate, because President Kennedy and Attorney General Kennedy were both sort of in that place where they said, yeah, you know, that would be great, just slow down, right? Trying to remember which Kennedy actually called Coretta Scott King while Martin Luther King was in jail, had a very sort of tense conversation with each other, because it was clear that Dr. King being in jail was of national interest, and it was also of international interest. So this is a place, this is one of the ways to look at the resistance in the Kennedy administration to what was going on in Birmingham, because the Soviet Union could tell what was going on in the United States and was able to say, hey, look at how poorly the United States treats their own citizens. Aren't you glad you live under the Soviet Union? So it was this black eye on the Kennedy administration and the on American culture and laws in general was also a great sort of propaganda fodder for the Soviet Union. You can see how President Kennedy wanted to keep the lid on that, right? Keep that sort of, you know, don't make it look too bad for us, right? By the time it came time to pass the Civil Rights Act, it was more clear, and I think, help me out, when was JFK shot?
November 1963.
So it was 64 then when the Civil Rights Act was being passed and Johnson was president, and he was also aware in that political sense that he needed, in order to pass the Civil Rights Act and get this done, he actually needed those visible demonstrations to keep pressure on his constituency, which was Congress, right? So the dynamics did change. That was some of the success of Birmingham. You can't draw too straight a line between Birmingham and the Civil Rights Act because there were a lot of things that happened in the intervening year. But yes, so I would venture to say that Johnson was a different kind of politician than Kennedy was. This isn't about either of them, but I would venture to say that probably there was a piece of difference in the way that that the kid from Boston and the kid from wherever in Texas Johnson was from, the way that they approached sort of that political process, and the facts on the ground had shifted. Part of the way that the idea that this is a Southern problem functioned was to try to sort of identify, yeah, there's this weird part of America, we're working on it, as an international relations move. There's this weird part of America, we're working on it, but there's no racism anywhere else. And Dr. King was unsatisfied with that as a response. He would, I think, continue to identify the ways that when we white moderates are upset that these racial tensions are coming to the surface, whether they're coming to the surface in Ferguson or Baltimore or St. Paul or Toledo, whichever city in Ohio where Tamir Rice was. When we see these, or heaven forbid, there should be actual sort of understanding of racism in Des Moines, right? When we see these come to the surface, that's hard for us, partly because it doesn't fit this mythology that this was all a Southern problem. It was unique in the South, but it was pervasive.
I think that one of the things that it did was bring out the fact that, I mean, everybody in the, I won't speak that way, I in the North would say, you didn't see signs over water fountains in the North that said whites only.
Right.
It wasn't very blatant until some of the rioting, and then as the riot, some of the rioting actually got a little, moved up, because I remember there was an entire area in the Cincinnati area that was, I don't know, how do you say it? It was a portion of this of the suburbs of Cincinnati where it was a black community. It was the black high school. It was the black everything. And the rest of us kind of avoided that. Or if we played football with them, the crowds were less.
Right.
Because you had a tension. But you didn't have any, it wasn't outright fighting. It was just...
Right.
Which is there.
Right.
So I think some of what the march did was bring it to the forefront and say, well, what is it like around here? And then when they did start some rioting in the Cincinnati area and burning stuff out, then the comment I remember from some people was like, well, why in the heck would they destroy their own houses?
Right.
You know, I mean, it was just, it was nonsensical, and it was also made to the point where people that were unhappy with that were, I think they were more frightened than anything else. And didn't know what to do to help.
Yeah. And there's a lot of real, I almost said legitimate, I'm not sure that's the right word to use here, but real fear around the way that we have experienced racial division in the United States. And some of that is that sense of the tension, right? That there is tension that is, broadly speaking, racially defined. There are other layers of tension, right? Talking about one thing doesn't mean that other things don't exist. But there is, broadly speaking, racial tension built into the sort of American systems, whether they're systems about where do people live, right? So why was there a black high school in Cincinnati, right? Because there was a part of town where all sorts of legal and extra-legal means meant that here's where the black people live, here's where the lines for their high schools are, and that these were ways of continuing to, without posting whites-only signs over the water fountains, ways to structure society so that black people are over here and white people are over here. And that is a tension, right? So when we find ourselves moving into that tension, we necessarily feel the tension that's there. And, you know, discomfort and fear are not so different from each other. There is a portion in the letter, and I can't find it immediately, but it's toward the end, that Dr. King specifically addresses the risk to society if the nonviolent resistance is not somehow received and acted upon. And he talks about the way that the tension that the white community did not want to feel. The way that tension is constantly felt by the Negro community. And he said, at some point, if we don't express this and resolve this, we're going to express it anyway in ways that are going to be violent. And he spoke it as a lament, not as a threat, but we can hear the danger in it as well. That's part of what is uncomfortable for us as we actually enter into addressing the legacy of racism, is that we know that there's pain and justifiable anger inside what we're trying to address. Okay, I'm going to let Dr. King preach again for a moment. I'm going to read to you. I really should read a third paragraph that I won't because it's a little long. But I'm going to read on page 4. There's a new section that begins, "You spoke of our activity in Birmingham as extreme." I should read that whole paragraph to you. I won't. But I will read the next two paragraphs. So again, it's addressing this charge that Dr. King and this march are extremists. "Oppressed people cannot remain oppressed forever. The urge for freedom will eventually come. This is what has happened to the American Negro. Something within has reminded him of his birthright of freedom. Something without has reminded him that he can gain it. Consciously and unconsciously, he has been swept in by what the Germans call the Zeitgeist. And with his black brothers of Africa and his brown and yellow brothers of Asia, South America, and the Caribbean, he is moving with a sense of cosmic urgency toward the promised land of racial justice. Recognizing this vital urge that has engulfed the Negro community, one should readily understand public demonstrations. The Negro has many pent-up resentments and latent frustrations. He has to get them out." This is the paragraph I was just talking about. Found it. "So let him march sometime. Let him have his prayer pilgrimages to the city hall. Understand why he must have sit-ins and freedom rides. If his repressed emotions do not come out in these nonviolent ways, they will come out in ominous expressions of violence. This is not a threat. It is a fact of history. So I have not said to my people, get rid of your discontent. But I have tried to say that this normal and healthy discontent can be channeled through the creative outlet of nonviolent direct action. Now this approach is being dismissed as extremist. I must admit that I was initially disappointed in being so categorized. But as I continued to think about the matter, I gradually gained a bit of satisfaction from being considered an extremist. Was not Jesus an extremist in love? Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you? Was not Amos an extremist for justice? Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Was not Paul an extremist for the gospel of Jesus Christ? I will bear in my body the marks of the Lord Jesus. Was not Martin Luther an extremist? Here I stand, I can do no other, so help me God. Was not John Bunyan an extremist? I will stay in jail to the end of my days before I make a mockery of my conscience. Was not Abraham Lincoln an extremist? This nation cannot survive half slave and half free. Was not Thomas Jefferson an extremist? We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. So the question is not whether we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be. Will we be extremists for hate, or will we be extremists for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice, or will we be extremists for the cause of justice? Dr. King reminds us that though we may pursue the illusion of moderation, in reality we cannot avoid taking a stand. Mere lukewarm acceptance of the concerns of African Americans and other disadvantaged groups, which tacitly communicates that we have already made sufficient progress, presents a stumbling block to authentic change. As Dr. King recognized, the moderate, quote, prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice. In contrast, being a Christian necessitates forsaking the comfort and safety of our social order when it rests on less than God's intention. So Dr. King identifies those of us who have benefited from the comfort and safety of our social order. How have we benefited from the comfort and safety of our social order?
We can ignore what's going on.
We can ignore what's going on. We have the option to turn off the news. We have the option to not go to this, that, or the other neighborhood. We have the option to know that our experience is the normative experience that sort of everybody else's experience is measured in terms of.
We can do pretty much what we want because of being white.
Pretty much, yeah.
If we went to see the Green Book, which was very enlightening as far as, I didn't know what a Green Book was until the movie, which if anybody didn't see it, was the book that showed where black people could stay, mm-hmm. as opposed to a typical Holiday Inn, they had to go to a specific area.
Mm-hmm.
And so right. We can check into any hotel we want.
Right. And which is not the same as feeling that we would in fact feel comfortable in any hotel, right? Because we draw our map in certain ways that means I don't really want to go stay on that side of town, right? That's usually lines up pretty well with what's in the Green Book, actually. But we can assume that we're going to be welcome in public accommodations. We can assume that we're going to be perfectly safe in interactions with law enforcement. We can assume that we're going to be more or less fairly considered for any job we apply for. So yeah, these are some places where it's sort of the world is built for our convenience. The Green Book is not only a Southern idea either. The idea that you may not be able to safely stay in public accommodations is a nationwide question. The Green Book itself, I don't believe, is in common use anymore, but the ideas underneath it still obtain, and certainly at the time it was not only a Southern problem, it was, again, Jim Crow was a uniquely Southern institution that masked the way that that segregation continued to play out throughout the country. And that we didn't have to pay much attention to if we didn't want to.
There must have been a book about Northerners in spring break of 1965, because four of us in a Volkswagen with Iowa plates and Daytona Beach or bust and electrical tape on the side of the door, we were refused that said rooms available at a motel in Mississippi.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't think we looked too threatening, but
we're college students on spring break.
Yeah.
Pretty threatening.
We were not spending but one day with them.
Right.
And at that point, we had money. It was the beginning of the trip. We went straight south to Mississippi, then worked our way through Alabama over to Florida. And first thing I did was I took the tape off the Daytona Beach or bus business. Mm-hmm. Couldn't change the license plates.
Right.
But I knew they had rooms, and we were denied. We don't have any rooms for you guys.
Uh-huh.
And we were sober.
At that point.
At that point. They hadn't made it to Daytona Beach.
We weren't at the festive part of Daytona Beach. We were just wanting to see some interesting country. Go down one way and come back another.
Their experience, though, is torn up rooms.
Right, yeah.
Thank you, Bob, but I can assure you, I was calm in that year, and you guys with me were not too threatened.
You just got prejudged.
Yeah, prejudged, exactly. Yeah.
And so when we identify, again, pervasive racism, we're not denying that that white college students headed on spring break
from the north,
might also be judged as white college students on spring break. There was also, obviously, throughout the 60s, there were well-meaning northern white folks going down and intruding in the south. So not having been there, I don't know sort of on which grounds you were discriminated against, either as, oh, these look like college students and they're going to leave the place torn up, or these look like interlopers coming down to promote civil rights that we don't want to have promoted here. I can't say which group you got lumped into. But imagine going through life knowing that even walking up to that counter was dangerous for you to do. That even walking up to that counter, if that motel is not determined to be safe for you, you could walk up to that counter and get lynched for it. So the way that that tension was present in the lives of African Americans was very different from the way that tension became present for white Americans. Now, what does that say to that question of extremism? What is Dr. King getting at with the idea that you can either be an extremist on the side of injustice or an extremist on the side of justice? Those are your choices. In that context, what is Dr. King getting at?
You are a hindrance as a lukewarm moderate. You're part of the problem.
Yeah, and in what way is the lukewarm moderate part of the problem? Looking sort of back at that historical moment, in what way would a lukewarm moderate be part of the problem?
You're not willing to stand up and do what it takes to make things right, I guess. Kind of just sitting back and ignoring it.
Mm-hmm. And what does that do? What is it?
Well, it's not going to facilitate change.
No. Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to be... You're just kind of wanting the status quo. For someone like us, it's fine, but for them, that doesn't. It's just wait a little longer.
Right. So the status quo is violent, right? The status quo is unjust, and so to resist change, you know, to at least decline to participate in change to the status quo means you're voting for the status quo. And it creates a sense that, oh, most people aren't worried about this, right? Creates a sense that, you know, that's an isolated problem that doesn't really need to be addressed because look at all of these people who don't care. It is a rhetorical device, right? It's a rhetorical device to say, now is the time to change, get up and get with me. There's also a lot of just political science truth to it. That if you can't demonstrate the constituency for this change is now urgent, then it's easy to dismiss the call for change. That's one of the sections that troubles me the most in the letter, because boy, am I a white moderate. I have the things that I think and believe, and I also really don't want to make myself uncomfortable. I really don't want to step out. I don't want to make anybody around me uncomfortable either. I don't want to be in that tension. And so in what way, you know, in what way, this is a rhetorical question, I hope, in what way am I called to enter into that tension? In what way is that choice still between present unjust systems and justice that that is obviously better than that? In what way is that choice still sitting in front of me, and what will I do? I'm going to leave that there to make sure it stays a rhetorical question. But we will come to sort of a wrap-up next week, talking about, well, to answer the rhetorical question, where is it we're called to speak up, and how is it that, particularly as a church, we're called to shape the social norms around us. So that will be our question next week.
It's got less to do with this and more the meeting next week. Won't we be in the north classrooms because we have the birthday party?
Yes, we will. Thank you for that.
Because usually I don't realize it until we get here.
Right. So yes, we'll be in the north classroom next week because the birthday potluck follows worship next week. So we'll be up there. So plan that into your arrival time, Jean.
Yes.
I have one question on an incident that happened this week in Des Moines. I'm just asking your opinion.
Okay.
A Supreme Court justice was selected and was seated or whatever, and he was half Irish and half Vietnamese.
Right.
And the headline was, we had a man of color on the Iowa Supreme Court. And I'm just saying, the newspaper that we all depend upon... I did not think of Asian as being people of color. Now, that's Warren Pitcher. You know, he led a sheltered life. The fact that it was Irish and Vietnamese, and that the paper saw the need to even indicate that we now have had a man of color on the Irish people.
Mm-hmm.
That struck me too.
What nationalities are considered people of color, maybe was the thing that I was ignorant of,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't see Asian as being the first time I've ever heard them addressed as people of color.
Why would you even say that in the first place?
Well, that's the newspaper for you.
Yeah.
But that just struck me so out of the ordinary, and
so,
I never thought about what races are people of color.
Right. That's a fantastic question, and I want to really commend you for just surfacing it, because it is,
yeah,
it's one of those places where we find ourselves walking into some of that tension, right? Some of the tension that is race relations in the United States. And so the question, wait, what is it that makes someone a person of color? Now, Asian Americans would be able to tell you, I would imagine pretty much unanimously, that absolutely Asian American is a set of racial groups. There's East Asian, Southeast Asian, South Asian, and obviously bajillions of countries in that. But people of color can tell you what the experience of being a person of color is. And as white people, we are often blind to what those experiences are. And I put it in those terms because I completely understand where you're coming from. That
this is a footnote. He did not look dark-complected at all.
As far as it should have said non-white.
His physical appearance, you would not, mm-hmm. I mean, you just wouldn't assume.
But right. If you went on to read some of what it said, one of the objections he had was when he filled out
yes.
a questionnaire,
yeah.
he said there's no place, there's no other here.
Because
I don't fit into these categories.
I don't fit these boxes.
Yeah.
Right. And you mentioned the term non-white, which is another way to describe the same thing that person of color identifies. The difference is that non-white centers whiteness, right? That you're either white or you're not. As opposed to language like people of color is trying to bring a little bit closer to the center the racialized experiences of those who are not identified as white. But if the normative experience at the center is here's white and then there's everybody else, then it's still there. It's like there's something wrong with everybody else for not quite being white. We touched on that a little bit last week when Tom mentioned the identifying the first African American president. Who was also half white, right? And so what does it mean to be white or to be a person of color? You could categorize both people as biracial, right? Which is part of the, there's no box for that, right? If you have to choose one, there's no box for half Irish, half Vietnamese. There's no box for half Kansan, half Kenyan, right? There's no box for that. But the way that racial identity is constructed in the United States says you're either white, or if you're even partly not white, you're not white. People of color language is an attempt to bring their experience a little closer to the center. So it's not you're either white or you're not. But rather, it's more complicated than that. Why would it be important to identify the first person of color on the Iowa Supreme Court as the first person of color on the Iowa Supreme Court?
To show that they're not white.
Progress.
Well, yes, it looks like we're making progress.
Right. It can look like we're making progress. We can also look at the past 173 years and wonder how much progress we made, or why it took us 173 years to get from all white men on the Supreme Court to mostly white men. There's a couple of white women on the Supreme Court, right? And one person of color. That took us 173 years. So there is some value in saying, okay, that happened. It always has to come in conversation with, that took 173 years. How long should it have taken? So that's that racial awareness leads us into a tension that we don't necessarily feel comfortable going into.
Thank you for letting me interject.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for bringing that up. And I think those are great points of recognizing this is where that this is where what we're talking about is present in our lives. So thank you for that. Next week, okay. North Classroom.
Warren, maybe they were trying to bring out the fact that they had an Irish.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.